Before we get started, we'll pause for a few moments of silent prayer. Rebound if necessary. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity and the privilege of gathering here in order to study your word. We're so grateful for the fact that this nation, this client nation, was founded by those who were oriented to your word and its guidance. We thank you that because of these individuals, what they knew and the system they put in place has enabled us to remain a client nation for over 240 years. It is our obligation as a member of the Royal Pivot in the 21st century to do our duty to study your word, retain it, and apply it in our daily lives so that freedom might be continued yet for the next generation. Encourage us by our study. We lift our prayer of gratitude in the name of Christ, our Savior. Amen. We're at part five, which is the Constitution taking sides. This shifts our focus away from the Declaration over to the concept of the Constitution. And here we're going to note the tug of war between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. And we'll see who these people are. They're going to be identified as we go through this. But Virginia, as we've noted, was a key state in the ratification process. And in Virginia, there were stalwarts of independence who were openly opposed to the concentration of power in a centralized government. That left the states and their citizens with no guarantees of their rights would not be infringed. So you have Federalist and Anti-Federalist. The Federalist are those that are meeting in primarily up in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. I got to the point as I studied this that when I got done, I'm not too happy about Benjamin Franklin. We're going to see tonight that the Constitution was put forward for consideration for the colonies, by the colonies, in an illegal move by Franklin. And we'll see how that plays out. What you need to know as we go through this is that the convention was held in Philadelphia with the idea of putting together a constitution that would then be returned to the colonies for their analysis, and then they would feed information back to Philadelphia eventually about changes or alterations of various kinds. In other words, the states were to have a look at this first, send back data to Philadelphia, and then they would have another convention, and then they would decide how that part of it would go. Patrick Henry is going to be very upset about the way they handled it, and that's what we'll see this evening. Those who opposed the Constitution without amendments were the Anti-Federalists, and that included Patrick Henry, George Mason, Richard Henry Lee, James Monroe, George Clinton, William Grayson, and Edmund Randolph. Without Virginia's consent, even if ratified, the Union would be split and the Constitution would be ineffective. Those favoring ratification of the Constitution without amendments were termed Federalists. And they were comprised primarily of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, who primarily was involved in writing the Constitution. There were others, but he primarily. Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. Now, they are Federalist. They wanted the Constitution without amendments. Washington's dream depended on winning the favor of the voice of independence, Patrick Henry. Upon his return to Mount Vernon, Washington wrote this to Henry. In the first moments of my return, I take the liberty of sending you a copy of the Constitution, which the Federal Convention has submitted to the people of these states. I wish the Constitution had been made more perfect, but I sincerely believe it is the best that could be obtained at this time. And as a constitutional door is opened for amendment hereafter, the adoption of it under present circumstances of the Union is, in my opinion, desirable. The political concerns of this country are suspended by a thread. If nothing had been agreed upon, anarchy would soon have ensued, the seeds being ripely sown in every soil. Well, Henry was not in the mood to receive such correspondence from the man whom he admired most among his fellow patriots. His disgust was so adamantly directed toward the Constitution that he could only respond to Washington in muted tones. Here's what he wrote to George Washington. I have to lament that I cannot bring my mind in accord with the proposed Constitution. The concern I feel on this account is really greater than I am able to express. Perhaps mature reflection may furnish me reasons to change my present sentiments into a conformity with the opinion of those personages for whom I have the highest reverence. Be that as it may, I beg you will be persuaded of the unalterable regard and attachment with which I ever shall be, dear sir, your obliged and very humble servant. In other words, I don't like it. Henry's concerns were so numerous that he felt it inappropriate to enumerate them in a letter to Washington. I've learned that Patrick Henry revered George Washington. He was a man of great honor and integrity. He was from Virginia. He became the first president of the country. And as you know, in the debates they had at Richmond with regard to taking up arms against the British, that George Washington stepped forward and said that he would recruit an army and the first 1,000 that he would subsist with his own money and then lead them in the fight against the British. So Henry takes great pains not to in any way insult Washington. He disagrees with him on this occasion, but you can see he went to great pains to let him know that he had great respect for him. So Henry's concerns were so numerous that he felt it inappropriate to enumerate them in a letter to Washington. He would save his objections for the upcoming debates. Certain phrases in the Constitution hinted at inevitable tyranny, such as the threat of unlimited and unbounded power over the states, granted in the final paragraph of Article 1, Section 8. Here's how that reads. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. And Henry was further troubled that there were no term limits for the president, members of Congress, and the judiciary. All could serve indefinitely and possibly collude to create tyranny, collude with foreign governments to sell territorial rights, as Congress had almost done with Spain regarding the Jay Gardoqui Treaty. A little bit of information on that. It's at the bottom of the page in a footnote. This treaty, negotiated by John Jay and Spain's Diego de Gardoqui, would have given Spain navigation rights on the Mississippi River for 25 years, which Henry successfully opposed. So he was in opposition to that. Why give the Mississippi River to Spain for 25 years? You'll note that in 25 years, we're going to buy from France everything west of the Mississippi, just about. But Spain would have had navigation rights on that particular river. Henry didn't like the government having the power to maintain a standing army, impose taxes without consent of the states, to negate state laws and enforce federal laws with troops. I don't know if you remember that over the course of my lifetime, the President of the United States has dispatched federal troops into the states to enforce some kind of laws that they felt needed to be enforced. This is what Henry feared, is that too much power was given to the executive and to Congress, so that they could impose upon the states the desire of those in authority in Washington. I can tell you that when I was a child in the eighth grade, part of the curriculum for those in the eighth grade in Troy, Alabama, was to study the war between the states. We were given the task of researching through the library and other sources. We had to learn about the generals, both North and South. We had to know about battles that were fought, who won them and why, all of the details with regard to that four-year war. And we were taught that the reason the South, and particularly South Carolina, seceded was that they felt like they had the right to secede. There was no reason why they had to stay in the Union. There was nothing in the Constitution that said that they couldn't leave the Union. And so they did. The North decided that they couldn't leave the Union and decided to send an armada, that would be Abe Lincoln, an armada down to Charleston Bay. And in other words, sit out there in the water until South Carolina decided to do something about it. Finally, South Carolina fired after a number of days, and therefore Lincoln blamed the South for starting the war. South Carolina firmly believed that the states had the right to do whatever they needed to do. If they wanted to leave the Union, they could or not. And so this is where the real crux of the war between the states began. It had to do with states' rights. In other words, the federal government doesn't have the power to tell the individual states what to do unless they've given the power by the Constitution. And so we were taught, at least in that schoolroom, that the whole issue was over states' rights. And this is something that you see emerging here, is why Patrick Henry is upset about a number of things. His primary concern was that the states lost their sovereignty, the individual rights to freedom of speech, religion, press, trial by jury, redress of grievances, and freedom of assembly. These rights were not protected. Virginia's Declaration of Rights guaranteed all these things, but they now could be overridden by the superior federal government. Many of the grievances expressed in the Declaration of Independence were now again a concern to Henry. The states had abused this power under the Confederation. Now it was given to the superior Congress. Representatives, and here's the quote, "Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states." Got that? "Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states," introduces Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3. Henry had long opposed any permanent national government tax, yet the Constitution granted this power in its very first article. Henry's fears have presently been proved prophetic. In February 1913, the 16th Amendment was ratified and reads, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived." Today, the power to tax has allowed Congress to wittingly run up a national debt that is on the verge of $20 trillion. Henry's objections, along with those of George Mason and Richard Henry Lee, had significant impact outside of Virginia. The Freeman's Journal of Philadelphia cautioned about Congress's power to lay and collect taxes. That edition, September 26, 1787. Philadelphia's Independent Gazetteer wrote that the Constitution would create, quote, "a permanent aristocracy." Went to press on October the 5th of 1787. The Massachusetts Sentinel warned, "You are forging chains for yourself and your children. Your liberties are at stake." Published November the 17th of 1787. Anti-Federalists were swaying public opinion against ratification, but in the state legislatures, the Federals held majorities and were able to call conventions. By February of 1788, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania had ratified the Constitution. The vote in Pennsylvania was literally stolen by the strong-arm tactics of none other than Benjamin Franklin. Franklin ignored all principles of self-government by leading the delegation out of the Constitutional Convention and marching into the Pennsylvania Assembly Hall in the same building. Interrupting the Assembly's proceedings, he all but promised that Philadelphia would be the new federal capital if Pennsylvania was the first to ratify the Constitution. He urged state legislators to call a state ratification convention immediately and without debate. Like other major property owners in the city, Franklin stood to reap enormous profits if the new government established the capital in Philadelphia. Angry backcountry anti-federalists, however, refused to appear in the assembly and left it 2 members short of the quorum. Speaker Thomas Mifflin, the wealthy Philadelphia merchant, ordered a sergeant at arms and a clerk to find at least 2 absent members and order them into the hall. A mob of Federalists followed the 2 to the boarding house where many anti-Federalists lodged and physically dragged 2 assemblymen back to their seats in the state house where, despite their shouts of protest, sentries physically restrained them while Federalists voted to hold the ratification convention on November the 20th. That sounds right up to date, doesn't it? Patrick Henry was appalled that Philadelphia was tricked into ratifying the Constitution. Governor George Clinton of New York was prepared to secede rather than allow his state to relinquish its sovereignty to a national government. And that brings us to part 6, the fight for the Bill of Rights. When Patrick Henry arrived in Richmond to participate in Virginia's consideration of the Constitution, he felt confident that his arguments held enough weight to convince the delegates to withhold their vote for ratification. If Virginia, the largest state in the Union, declined to ratify, then New York would follow, dealing a vital blow to the success of the venture. So New York was also a highly populated state, and Governor Clinton was opposed to this whole deal, especially after learning what happened at Philadelphia. So Henry was adamant that if the Constitution were to become law, it must be amended with a Bill of Rights. Otherwise, he had serious objections to allowing the document to stand alone. The Declaration had specifically cited King George III, quote, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. Yet the Constitution gave Congress unlimited power to tax the people without consent of state legislatures. The Declaration challenged England's deployment of a standing army in the colonies, while the Constitution authorized a standing army which could be sent into any state to enforce federal laws. Been talking to some people from the state of Arkansas. I see some grins, obviously from the state of Arkansas. That started a sequence of events that have transpired over a good period of time where the federal authority has sent federal troops into the individual states in order to enforce some type of federal desire. You may agree with the outcome of some of those incidences, and that's fine. You're free to believe in whatever you desire. The issue is the way in which things are handled. The state's rights concept went away in Little Rock, Arkansas, back in the 50s, under the command of the General of the Armies and head of the Department of DOD, Dwight Eisenhower. So I'm just saying to you, sometimes things may happen with which you agree, but the question that has to be posed, was it done in a right way? And so I'm trying to get across to you why Patrick Henry feared the Constitution written as it was, without amendments. And so when the amendments finally were attached, about 75 were presented to be considered. 12 were approved for ratification by the colonies, and 10 of them actually were passed by the vote of the colonies. And that's our top 10, that's our Bill of Rights. Those are the first 10 amendments. So to repeat, the delegation challenged England's deployment of a standing army in the colonies, while the Constitution authorized a standing army which could be sent to any state to enforce federal laws. Henry was also leery of the Constitution's provision in Article 6, which stipulates that, quote, and this is really a doozy, all treaties made, or which shall be made, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Okay, why is that a bad idea? I think a really bad treaty was entered into with Iran. That's my personal opinion. You may disagree, and that's fine. But that meant we had to honor that above all other provisions, state law or federal law. Treaty trumps the Constitution, in other words. And if it's a bad treaty done by bad men, then we have a bad outcome. Henry's recall of the narrowly defeated Jay Gardoki Treaty made him highly suspect of this provision. He was essential in having that particular treaty defeated. That's the Mississippi River deal. Once convened, Henry opened the debate, and what is convened is the Virginia Convention for Ratification. As was the custom, he addressed his comments to the chairman, George Mason. So he enters his comments, Mr. Chairman. Now, when I was putting this together, I was afraid that I had gone too far, that to take up the subject of the fight for the Bill of Rights was going to probably throw me into the seventh hour. And so I had to abbreviate this far more than I desired. I really wanted to take a look at his structure of his commentary and to show, if I could, some parallel with the debates that he had with regard to the Declaration. And it turns out that I could have done that and had that sixth hour. But nevertheless, here we go. You'll find this quite interesting, I think, because he has to debate the people in Virginia about the necessity for a Bill of Rights. Now, a lot of the people who are playing big parts in the development of the Constitution were Virginians. So he's talking to guys that are guilty of putting this thing forward. Mr. Chairman, I consider myself as the servant of the people of this Commonwealth, as a sentinel over their rights, liberty, and happiness. I represent their feeling when I say that they are exceedingly uneasy. Before the meeting of the late Federal Convention in Philadelphia, a general peace and a universal tranquility prevailed in this country. But since that period, I can see the Republic to be in extreme danger. Whence has written this fearful jeopardy? It arises from this fatal system. It arises from a proposal to change our government, a proposal that goes to the utter annihilation of the most solemn engagement of the states. That this is a consolidated government instead of a confederation is demonstrably clear, and the danger of such a government is, to my mind, very striking. Henry then accused the convention of a coup d'etat, since its permission to assemble in Philadelphia was granted by Congress for the purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to the state legislatures alterations and provisions, yet instead it had created a new government. To this he directed his comments to the presumptuousness of its preamble. I have the greatest veneration for those worthy characters who composed a part of the late Federal Convention, but, sir, give me leave to demand what right they had to say, we the people. Okay, that's how the whole deal begins. We the people, blah, blah, blah. Why did he disagree with that phraseology? Because it's not about the people, it was about the states. It should have read, we the states, in his opinion. But it didn't. My political curiosity leads me to ask who authorized them to speak the language of we the people. The people gave them no power to use their name. That they exceeded their power is perfectly clear. The Federal Convention ought to have amended the old system. For this purpose, they were solely delegated. The object of their mission extended to no other consideration. I would demand the cause of their conduct, even from that illustrious man who saved us by his valor. And we're talking Washington here. I would demand a faithful historical detail of the reasons that actuated its members in proposing an entire alteration of government and to demonstrate the dangers that awaited us. Disorders have arisen in other parts of America, but here, sir, no dangers, no insurrection, no tumult has happened. Everything has been calm and tranquil. What are the causes for this proposal to change our government? Now, when I was in school, and it may be the case for you, we were taught that the Articles of Confederation could not work. It was too loosely put together for a United States to be able to function properly. That's not his point. His point is we have Articles of Confederation, and the colonies have allowed you to assemble in order to consider ways to make it more effective for a United States. And you therefore are to mend this in ways that you feel necessary, put it back to the colonies for their analysis and approval. It was a process that was to rock back and forth until everybody got happy. One of the more prominent anti-federalists, the sitting governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, followed Henry, and it was expected that he would compliment Henry's remarks. That he did not resulted in the tide shifting in Washington and the Federalist favor. As a member of the Constitutional Convention, said Randolph, I refused to sign. And if the same were to return, again would I refuse. But I never will assent to the scheme that will operate a dissolution of the Union or any measure which may lead to it. The Union is the anchor of our political salvation, and I will assent to the lopping of this limb before I assent to the dissolution of the Union. And then Randolph then turned and looked at Henry. I shall follow the honorable gentleman in his inquiry while we assume the language of we the people. I ask, why not? The government is for the people. Is it unfair? Is it unjust? I take this to be one of the least and most trivial objections that will be made to the Constitution. In the whole of this business, I have acted in the strictest obedience to my conscience in discharging what I conceive to be my duty to my country. I refused my signature. I would still refuse. But as I think that those 8 states which have adopted the Constitution will not recede, then I am a friend of the Union. Henry and George Mason were livid at the betrayal by Edmund Randolph, and Henry believed the Tidewater aristocracy of Virginia, of which Randolph was one, sought to recapture the powers it held in the state's colonial House of Burgesses. Federalist light horse Harry Lee began the next day's debates by taking up where Randolph left off. I feel every power of my mind moved by the language of the honorable gentleman yesterday, the éclat and brilliancy which have distinguished that gentleman, the honors with which he has often been dignified, and the brilliant talents which he has so often displayed have attracted my respect and attention. On so important an occasion, I expected a new display of his powers of oratory, but instead of proceeding to investigate the merits of the new plan of government, the worthy character, informed us of the horrors which made him tremblingly fearful of the fate of the Commonwealth. The gentleman sat down as he began, leaving us to ruminate on the horrors which he opened with, "But, sir, this system is to be examined on its own merit. Mr. Chairman, was it proper to appeal to the fear of this House? I trust he is come here to judge and not to alarm." Now, all Lee's comments did was steel Henry's resolve even more than did Randolph's the day before. Henry's retort to Lee isolated the reasons free men should be wary of offering unfettered power to a central government. Now, this is going to be sort of a rock and roll here. There's going to be a number of people in the gallery, and he is going to get his blood up, and he's going to start asking questions, and that's going to be his argument. And his argument is going to cite a number of things that he believes the Constitution left without amendments is going to cause. And he's going to have the gallery respond. Apparently, when people had a debate and they allowed people into the place where the debate was taking place, that they were free to say, "Yes, I think that's a good idea," or "No, I don't." So we'll see how that plays out, but you'll see it occur as we move through this. "I am much obliged to the very worthy gentleman for his encomium. I wish I was possessed of talents or possessed of anything that might enable me to elucidate on this great subject. I rose yesterday to ask a question. I thought the meaning was obvious. Here is a revolution as radical as that which separated us from Great Britain. If in this transition our rights and privileges are endangered, and the sovereignty of the states are relinquished, and cannot we plainly see that this is actually the case? The rights of conscience, trial by jury, liberty of the press, all your immunities and franchises, all pretensions to human rights and privileges are rendered insecure if not lost. Is this tame relinquishment of rights worthy of free men?" he cried out. "No," came the cry from the gallery buckskins. Presiding Officer George Wythe gaveled the hall to order. "Is the relinquishment of the trial by jury necessary and the liberty of the press necessarily for your liberty?" "No," again the rap of Wythe's gavel. "Will the abandonment of your most sacred rights tend to the security of your liberty?" "No." "A new form of government will oppress and ruin the people." The gallery erupted in angry noes until Wythe's gavel restored order. It is sad 8 states have adopted this plan. I declare, if 12 1/2 had adopted it, I would with manly firmness reject it. The gallery cheered. But I am fearful. I have lived long enough to become an old-fashioned fellow. If so, I'm contented to be so. 23 years ago, I was supposed a traitor to my country. No, the gallery protested. I was then said to be a bane of sedition because I supported the rights of my country. I say now our privileges and rights are in danger. Is not the ancient trial by jury preserved in the Virginia Bill of Rights? Yes, they answered. And is it the case in the new plan? No, the gallery responded angrily. No, sir, he echoed his response. Why do we love this trial by jury? Because it prevents the hand of oppression from cutting yours off. They may call everything rebellion and deprive you of a fair trial by an imperial jury of your neighbors. Shall Americans give up that which nothing could induce the English people to relinquish? The idea is abhorrent to my mind. It gives me comfort that as long as I have existence, my neighbors will protect me. Guard with jealous attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. And whenever you give up that force, you are inevitably ruined. Something must be done to preserve your liberty and mine. Henry then turned to Federalist Chairman With. The Constitution is said to have beautiful features. But when I come to examine these features, sir, they appear to me horribly frightful. Among other deformities, it was awful squinting. It has this awful squinting. It squints toward monarchy. So when I read this, I thought, what does it mean by squinting? Well, if you see something afar off and you try to focus, maybe in the far distance, you squint to make sure you can focus on that far off objective. And he's saying, if we take this Constitution as it's currently displayed to us, if you read it properly, you can squint that it will lead to monarchy. That was his fear. And does not this raise indignation in the breast of every American? Your president may easily become king. Where are your checks on this government? There will be no checks, no real balances in this government. It is on a supposition that your American governor shall be honest that all the good qualities of this government are founded. But its defective and imperfect construction puts it in their power to perpetuate the worst of mischiefs should they be bad men. Hoo-ah. This man's looking. We've just now gotten to the point of ratifying the Constitution, and he says this. I'll read that one again. There will be no checks, no real balances in this government. It is on a supposition that your American governors shall be honest that all the good qualities of this government are founded, that they be honest. But its defective and imperfect construction puts it in their power to perpetuate the worst of mischiefs should they be bad men. Show me that age and country where the rights and liberties of the people were placed on the sole chance that their rulers being good men without a consequent loss of liberty. Every one of these guys that run for office, local, state, federal, they present themselves as good men and good women. It doesn't play out for a lot of them. If your American chief be a man of ambition and abilities, how easy it is for him to render himself absolute. If Congress, in the execution of their unbounded power, shall have done wrong, how will you come at them to punish them? Henry then focused his attention on arguments in favor of ratification without the appending of a Bill of Rights. He reviewed the powers given the President and Congress, the power of unlimited direct taxation, powers to counteract and suspend state laws, and powers to send troops into any state to enforce federal laws, powers that in the hands of Parliament had provoked the War of Independence. The dangers were amplified by the power granted Congress in Article 1, Section 8, quote, to make all laws necessary for carrying out their powers into execution. Then he shouted, "Will you be safe when you trust men at Philadelphia with power to make any law that will enable them to carry their acts into execution? By this, they have a right to pass any law that may facilitate the execution of their acts. Is there any act, however atrocious, which Congress cannot do by virtue of this clause? Congress will become the supreme power. A wonderful and unheard experiment it will be to give unlimited power unnecessarily. This is dishonorable and disgraceful. It will be an oppressive in practice as it is absurd in theory." I trust that gentlemen will see the great objects of religion, liberty of the press, trial by jury, interdiction of cruel punishments, and every other sacred right secured before they agree to that paper. You have a Bill of Rights to defend you against the state governments, and you have none against Congress. If you intend to reserve your unalienable rights, you must have the most express stipulation. It is expressly declared in our Articles of Confederation that every right was retained by the states, which was not given up to the government of the United States. But there is no such thing here. You therefore, by a natural and unavoidable implication, give up your rights to that general government. Why not give us our rights in express terms, in language that could not admit of evasions or subterfuges? We are giving power, they are getting power. If you will stipulate that there are rights which no man under heaven can take from you, you shall have me going along with you, not otherwise. I speak as one poor individual, and when I speak the language of thousands. As the convention continued, Henry continued to plead for the inclusion of rights before ratification could be voted. Washington consistently rebuked the need for amendments, since the document contained, according to him, a constitutional door for amendment, to which Henry fired back in a polemic. Now, this is beautiful. Listen to this. Now, this is Washington, whom he reveres above all other men. I am constrained to make a few remarks on the absurdity of relying on the chance of getting it amended afterward. When it is confessed to be replete with defects, is it not offering to insult your understandings to attempt to reason you out of the propriety of rejecting it till it is amended? Read that one again. When it is confessed to be replete with defects, is it not offering to insult your understandings to attempt to reason you out of the propriety of rejecting it till it is amended? Does it not insult your judgments to tell you, adopt first and then amend? Is your rage for novelty so great that you are first to sign and seal and then to retract? You agree to bind yourselves hand and foot for the sake of what? Of being unbound? You go into a dungeon for what? To get out? Is there no danger when you go in that the bolts of federal authority shall shut you in? Human nature never will part from power. Have we not a right to say, hear our propositions? If this moment goes away, we will never see it return. By the next morning, James Madison approached the moderate anti-federalist with a pledge to fight for the passage of a Bill of Rights in the first Congress if they switched their votes for ratification. We're noting moderate anti-federalist. That would be the guys that define those that line up with Patrick Henry. James Madison, who's the primary author of the Constitution, was the one to go forward to see if he could get enough people to come over to the Federalist side to get it passed. And then amend it later. So the result of the crossover voters gave the Federalists an 89-79 vote in favor of ratification. Whatever Virginia does, all the rest will ultimately follow. So it was agreed by most of the delegates that Madison's pledge to promote a Bill of Rights was the key factor in the Federalist victory. After the vote, the delegates assumed Henry would again regale the convention about the inherent dangers lurking behind their act, and he was, however, quite constrained. If I shall be in the minority, I shall have those painful sensations which arise from a conviction of being overpowered in a good cause. Yet I will be a peaceable citizen. My head, my hand, my heart shall be at liberty to retrieve the loss of liberty and remove the defects of this system, but in a constitutional way. I wish not to go to violence, but will wait with hopes that the spirit which predominated in the Revolution is not yet gone. nor the cause of those who are attached to the revolution yet lost. I shall therefore patiently wait in the expectation of seeing that government changed so as to be compatible with the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the people. And so once the new government was seated, Washington gave Madison approval to fulfill his pledge to Henry to propose a Bill of Rights. After taking his seat in the House of Representatives, he moved for amendments that may serve the double purpose of satisfying the minds of well-meaning opponents and of providing additional guards in favor of liberty. Madison failed to address the issue of states' rights, however, and Anti-Federalist Senator William Grayson expressed this outrage to Henry. Some gentlemen have it in contemplation to effect amendments which shall affect personal liberty alone, leaving the great points of the judiciary, direct taxation, etc., to stand as they are. Their object is unquestionably to break the spirit of the Anti-Federalist Party. After this, I presume many of the most sanguine expect to go on coolly in sapping the independence of the state legislatures. Another prophecy. 4 months later, Madison resolved that the Constitution be amended with a Declaration of the Rights of the People to ensure the tranquility of the public mind and the stability of the government. Although members proposed 75 amendments, the House approved only 17, and the Senate reduced the number to 12. The states ratified 10, which became known collectively as the Bill of Rights. After reading them, Henry exploded with rage over the failure of the amendments to restrict the national government's powers over the states. Here's what he wrote. I wrote the first of those amendments in these words, quote, "Each state in the Union shall respectively retain every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Constitution delegated to the Congress of the United States or to the departments of the federal government," end quote. But they have omitted it and changed it into this equivocal thing, "or to the people." My sons, this Constitution cannot last. It will not last a century. We can only get rid of it by the most violent and bloody struggle. And after Henry's first reading of the Constitution, he observed, "It squints toward monarchy." Now, in the 21st century, it no longer squints. It is being used by the powers that be with wide-eyed resolve to arrogate powers Henry feared some bad men would do. That takes us to an epilogue and a few things toward the end. This completes our study of Henry's impact on the Declaration and the Bill of Rights with regard to the Constitution. It's time now that we stop, and we've gone about almost an hour anyhow. We've got about 5 minutes to eight. And so we'll break now for our usual tea and crumpets. When we come back, I'll have a few comments to make in conclusion, and then we'll open the floor for questions if any of you have any to offer. So now it's time for us to pause for tea and crumpets.